that.
Actually, I'm sure your dad told me that he just found you one day under a stone and just took you
home. He actually bought me with tiger tokens.
Showing your age there.
All right, so
tiger tokens.
Welcome one and all to another juicy episode of Bad Voltage. And in the seat today, we don't just have Mr. Stuart Ian Langridge and I, but Jeremy sadly is out doing, I don't know what Jeremy does. No one really quite understands what it is. And we have the righteous Alan Pope here to stand in his very small shoes.
Hello,
thank
chaps.
You for joining us, Popey.
Yeah, no worries.
How you doing?
I'm all right, thanks. I should mute my Alexa because I just woke her up by talking to you, unfortunately. Let's just shut her up at the start.
Yeah,
let's
shut her up. Okay.
I'm like professional and everything.
Yeah, well, it's already ruined. Thanks for that then.
No, it's fine. I mean, as I understand it, I've been looking at the Magna Carta, and in order to run a podcast that's about technology, you have to have Popey on it now, it turns out. So,
speaking of Popey, Thanksgiving Day, obviously Thanksgiving in the US was last week, and as I stared into a turkey's bottom, I was reminded of Popey, because I was informed that the little fleshy bit that sticks out the back of it is called a Pope's nose in America. It's a Parson's finger or something, whatever it is.
It's a Parson's nose in the UK.
Yeah, so every time I look at a turkey's ass, I'm going to think of Popey, which is always a good thing.
That's lovely.
That's true love right there.
That's positively heartwarming.
So we're going to do news for an hour. Why don't you, Mr. Pope, kick it off as you're our guest?
Okay, so a little bit of bad news. Unfortunately, a piece of software was compromised with, unsurprisingly, in 2018, cryptocurrency nonsense. But the interesting thing, this was an NPM module, and there was an issue filed against it. It's called Event Stream. There was an issue filed against it, and it turns out that the module itself had been handed over by the maintainer to a new person. And it was the new person who compromised and published a bent version of this this module, which happens to be used by an awful lot of people. Interestingly, they didn't just jam in a miner or anything like that. They sought to obfuscate what they'd done, and they'd hidden it pretty well. And it took a little while for people to figure out exactly what nonsense had been done to this software. And then
really,
yeah, and then the issue is just full of people. Like link, you know how when you link one issue to another, it's loads of links to external repositories where they've had to modify, and then they cite this issue as the reason why they've had to modify their software. And so it's just full of people arguing about that the maintainer was a terrible person for handing it over to someone who put malware in it. Also, that guy was terrible for putting malware in there. How open source is terrible, and how this would never have happened with some other packaging system. And yeah, it's a bit of a shit show.
So people are arguing on the internet?
Yeah, I know, right? Who'd have thought it?
Yeah. Is that a thing?
It doesn't matter where you go, like whether it's YouTube comments or GitHub issues, there's always someone out to get their pitchforks out. And
it is true.
Yeah.
Everywhere. It's consistent. I thought years ago it was specific to a lot of open source, but not particularly outside of that. And boy, was I wrong. Jeez. People bickering left, right, and center. Is it all being fixed now, or is it still ongoing?
Yeah.
It was fixed very quickly. The problem was identified, and the NPM people pulled the module and so on. Now, interestingly, what the new maintainer didn't do was actually add a cryptocurrency miner to it. What they did was they made it look for another package that you had installed, and if it had that other package as well, then it stole the bitcoins out of it.
Really?
So yeah, so it wasn't installing a miner and jacking everyone's currency, jacking everyone's CPU up to a high level and in order to mine currency from them. It wasn't a miner at all. It was just out and out theft.
Right. And that would have been easy to spot. I like how inventive people are getting to hide this kind of stuff inside there. I mean, I like and hate in equal. I admire the chutzpah that these people have for hiding this stuff inside other people's software. The guy who put a piece of software in the Snap Store some months back, which also had a crypto miner payload, but they named the software System D in order to mask it in your top listing. So when you see high CPU utilization, you just go, oh, look, it's System D. That's normal.
That sort of thing is interesting because the Windows people have been fighting this for years. I mean, decades, literally. People naming their TSR virus or whatever, winword.exe or wordwind.exe or system64.exe or something like that, so that it doesn't show up, obviously. It's just rediscovering all these terrible old techniques from the 1990s about how to conceal viruses. The thing which I found interesting about this, I mean, we've talked before about how NPM stuff tends to be lots of little modules, and your dependencies themselves have dependencies, which themselves have dependencies. And obviously the usual suspects, well, this just proves that JavaScript is the worst thing ever, and I'm never going to use it. Now let me go back to managing all my memory manually in C like I do every day. But the thing that I found most worrying is the number of people who are prepared to just pile on the maintainer.
The previous maintainer.
Yes, so the previous maintainer, Dominic Tarr, was the maintainer of EventStream, it's called. Pretty low-level node thing. And he hasn't used it for years. Not really interested in maintaining it anymore, so he basically said, you know, I'm not interested in maintaining this. Someone mailed him and said, I'm interested in taking it over, and he went, great, okay, no problem, here you go. And then you've got a whole bunch of people saying, well, that's obviously the worst thing you do, and you owe a duty of care and responsibility and so on. But as far as I can tell, what that means is if you ever release a package ever and you get bored with it, you're best off to just abandon it.
Well, or it's an albatross around your neck that you're going to have to maintain for the rest of your life.
Exactly.
Unless you can go through some kind of vetting process for making sure that this new person, you know, who's volunteering to take over some software is a valid and reasonable and good person.
And you're already doing this for free, right? I mean, John, I'll give you a stupid example, right? Pick one of the KDE things you developed in like 2001 or something.
Maybe it could be the actual original invention of Twitter, because I invented Twitter way back then.
You did.
KWebstat.
I invented Twitter as well. That's brilliant.
Did you too?
KWebstat. You're quite right.
If only we'd set up a company, Pope.
There it is.
It wouldn't have succeeded.
Okay. Imagine someone emailed you today and said, hey, KWebstat was actually a really good idea. I'm interested in taking over the code base and modernizing it and so on. How much diligence do you think you'd put into checking that this person was totally brilliant and above board? You've got a bunch of people saying, oh, well, you know, but obviously I'd give them commit access first and let them get involved heavily in the project first, and then over a course of months we'd build trust and transfer. But you're not really doing anything on the project.
Well, I mean, but KWebstat is abandonware. Right, it's a project.
Essentially, EventStream. Dominic Tarr hadn't used it for years. He said himself, he's the maintainer, and he didn't even.
But other people used it, right?
Yeah, and that doesn't mean abandonware means that no one's developing it, not that nobody's using it, right?
No, but that's kind of what I'm saying.
I'm going
is
by
that
the definition of all these websites to let you steal DOS games. I don't know whether that's the official definition.
I mean, in my mind, if I know no one uses KWebstat, so therefore I wouldn't give a crap. But if I knew that, for example, if I'd written a bit of software and a lot of people were using it, but I just didn't have the time to focus on it. So actually a good example of this could be something like Linux UK way back in the day, right? When I was working on that and I completely lost interest in it and left the project, but I cared a lot about who took over it because I knew that there were a lot of people who were reading that site back then. But so I think it depends on the audience to a degree.
But also, you've got to think the motivation for this person like wanting this package was because it was popular. There's no point going for Kay Webstat or whatever it is, or something that's used by nobody, right? You want to target node modules that are used by a lot of other projects, and you target that. And all it takes is for you to look like a good citizen for a couple of months. You could have done that due diligence, and then the guy could just be sat there waiting and say, okay, I'm okay now. Right, now I'll push a version that's got the crypto miner or that goes and seeks out your Bitcoin wallets. You know, it doesn't.
Yeah.
You could play the long game, and the long game is only a couple of months longer than the short game. It's not that.
Yeah,
it's not that you have to sit and bake it for 10 months or
I wonder if that's how often that has happened, where people have faked being a legit contributor, and then they've actually been nefarious in some kind of way. I'm assuming it hasn't happened very much at all, but we're starting to see more and more of this kind of behavior starting to take shape.
And almost by definition, the only ones you know about are the ones that have been discovered.
But you might not be. They might not be nefarious on day one. They might not plan to be nefarious. They might have a bad day one day and decide, screw this, and I'm going to fuck these people up. Like, 2 years down the line. So it's not just that the person is, you know, once you've given them the keys, it doesn't matter whether they were intending to be bad from day one or they turn bad a year later, they're still bad, right? And they still have the keys.
You know, it's interesting. A lot of this gets down to I've noticed this increasing trend. I'm not sure if this is happening as much in the UK as it is happening over here, but a lot of people are paying more and more attention and interest in the sustainability of open source. When I was over at the Open Source Summit, I went to this little conference, one-day event in London, which was the Open Source Sustainability Summit. And it was basically an on-conference with a lot of people talking about how you handle the common sustainability issues in open source, whether it relates to maintainership or security or this, that, and the other. And one of the things, I've been to two of these events so far. They did one last year at GitHub. I couldn't go to that one, but there was an O'Reilly event with a similar topic the year before. And there was a lot of discussion, a lot of ideas, and people there looking at things from the right perspective, and their hearts are in the right place. But it was very difficult to see concrete action coming out of it, because there really aren't a lot of consistent trends in open source.
Right.
So I think we're going to start seeing more and more of this. And one of the things I've discovered, particularly since I became a consultant, worked with different companies, is just how much knowledge there is wrapped up. The things that the three of us consider fairly obvious in the open source world, I mean, it's an enormous amount of information that is very difficult for a lot of people outside of that world to actually pick up. Not because they're stupid or anything, just the volume of information and all the subtleties that are involved in that. And I think we're going to start seeing more and more of this applying over the years, as particularly as open source is powering, you know, electrical grids. And
it's funny you should say that.
Vehicles.
Just yesterday, Rich Hickey from Clojure wrote a lengthy piece on GitHub as a gist, and it's called "Open Source Is Not About You," and talking about how we can take input from people in the community, and we can listen to them, but we don't have to listen to them. We don't have to do what people in the community say. It is possible for us to, you know, given that we're giving our own time for this and taking money out of my retirement pot in order to pay people to work on this open source project that I don't have to do. You know, some people are a little ungrateful at what's been provided by these people who are working on open source software.
And I think people are ungrateful on the internet, Popey.
I know, right?
What's happening to the internet? Is this
to me? I feel like the sustainability conversation in open source feels like the kind of the digital wellness conversation in the rest of the world. You know, this whole thing about people are using too much screen time and so on. And is this a bad idea? And maybe it is. And maybe we should do something about it. And there's sort of a gradual perception that maybe something should be done about this, but no one's got any very clear ideas. And, anyone who says they do have a clear idea is either writing a very hand-wavy think piece or has a product to sell you, which they promise will completely solve the problem, neither of which are the case.
Right.
But as the conversation becomes in itself sustainable, then people will start talking about this more and more and thinking about it more and more, and maybe we'll come up with something. Just having people be aware of this is a good thing in itself, I think. There certainly aren't any easy technological fixes. It's a social problem.
I think you're right. Like the kind of people who are interested in the sustainability question are either technology people who want to write software to solve problems, of which you can't really write software to solve these kinds of problems, or they are not academics in a literal sense, but they're the kind of people who will write articles and blog posts and do talks and disseminate information. The hard work in the sustainability thing is about building consensus around common workflows.
Yes.
And there's not many people who are very good at that.
No.
And I think that's where it's difficult. Shall we move on?
Yes. Mm. That's an interesting
one. Do you want to do something now, El Jinjo?
Yeah, okay. This was just an interesting one, I thought. In China, jaywalking is a crime, right? For people who don't know about this, this is crossing the road in a place other than a designated crossing, which is a big thing in America. It's not a thing at all in the
UK.
It's
a crime?
Yeah.
Yeah.
My experience of China would suggest that it is, would have assumed it was not a crime, as everybody seems to jaywalk.
Well, I mean, I don't know the detail here, but the way they've decided to treat this is they have cameras filming places, and then if you're seen by a camera jaywalking, it takes a picture of you, identifies you with face recognition, and then publishes a great big picture of you on, like, public screens going, this person was jaywalking. So instead of criminal punishment, it's more kind of shaming as punishment, right? I can't decide whether I think that is in and of itself a good idea or a terrible idea. Leave that to one side for 1 second. But Dong Mingzhu, who runs a huge Chinese electrical company, got busted for this. But it turns out she wasn't jaywalking at all. There was just, her picture was on the side of a bus in an advert, and the bus drove past the camera and the camera took a picture of it in the road and then put her up in the horrible name and shame wall for jaywalking when she'd done nothing of the kind. And I can't decide whether I think this is hilarious or it's this appalling Orwellian cautionary tale for humanity. And every turns time out, I think about this, I change my mind.
Turns out AI doesn't work well. Who knew? Right.
Orwellian things can be funny as well, by the way.
There's so much about this that's just... I personally hate the fact that jaywalking is a thing, that it's a thing that you shouldn't do. And I laugh heartily whenever my American colleagues come to the UK and they see us just stroll out into the road when there's nothing coming and there is no likely harm. And they're like, oh my God, you should stop. And it's like, no, that's not a thing here. Stop it. And it shouldn't be a thing there. The only reason it exists is because the motor vehicle companies lobbied to get people off the roads so they could get their cars on the roads. It's just utter bullshit. And I hate it.
Right.
But that aside, the whole... China is going in a very strange direction, giving people scores like, you know, it's clout scores dialed up to 100 that, you know, people get punished and aren't able to buy train tickets or plane tickets based on their social grade within the country. And that is a thing. It's not even, you know, a speculative thing. It's an actual thing. And I feel for people who live in China because this is just normal life for them.
What's interesting, the shaming element of this, I think, is fascinating. I was, as I've shared multiple times on Bad Voltage, one of the things that pisses me off more than, I think, almost anything else on the planet is people who don't use their fucking indicator when changing lanes. It bothers me with such a intensity because I just think it's like such a simple solution to... changing lanes, and if you don't do it, it's really dangerous. You can cause accidents, you can kill people, whatever else. And I came up with a Kickstarter idea where you basically mount your cell phone on your dashboard, and when somebody acts like a dick, what it does is it's videoing, and then it automatically scans their license plate and basically uploads their behavior to a website, and it shames them. And
but it turns out you don't need that because people do that already. There are already Twitter accounts like you part like a dick and you part like a C word.
Really?
Yes, totally. And there are websites.
I've not seen this.
If you just search for someone's number plate, like if you ever watch one of these dash cam footage where someone drives like a complete penis and you know does something aggressive, if you then search for that number plate, you'll find it on these websites where people from the internet who weren't even involved in that conversation dogpile on the entry for that car. Oh, this man's terrible. He's from this town and they're all terrible in that town. And, you know, but there are websites. You just search for a number plate. You will find, you know, something about it.
I had no idea that. I feel like I'm going to have a very cathartic afternoon.
Oh, my God. It's great.
But what's interesting to me is the idea, I mean, this is one of those things that, again, is a good idea on paper, but is probably a bad idea in practice. And there's a psychological element here of, I think, people knowing that they could be shamed in their social circle in some capacity, I can see as being a very realistic deterrent. But then the problem with this is there is a fine line between shaming and bullying. And
some would say there is no line at all between those two things.
Well, it could be that fine. You know, so it would depend heavily on obviously how this is putting to action. But to me, of all of the things that you're going to shame people for, jaywalking? Mm. I mean, I would start with the indicating when changing lanes thing. Okay,
I think everyone has their red line. I mean, that's your red line. Someone else's might be dropping litter. Like if you do that in Singapore, you're in trouble. You know, everyone has their own definition of. And if you asked your listeners, you know, what would be your, you know, the hit list? What would you be up against the wall when Jono is king? You know, it would be something different. Yours is indicators. Yeah. Mine would be, you know, I don't know, something else. But
I think for our listeners, it's Jeremy's audio quality.
Now, that's not kind when he's not here to defend himself.
But there's a difference.
That's why I'm saying it.
Each of us like coming up with one, but for a government to implement it is a whole different ballgame.
Yeah. Also, devil's advocate question, right? Yes, China have this whole social score thing and it stops you from getting on trains and so on. But that happens to a lesser extent, certainly. But that happens to us as well. If you've things like your social media graph feed into your credit rating, into your credit score. People have been denied loans because their friends on social media are bad credit risks.
Citation needed.
I will happily provide you a citation because it's in one of my talks.
It's got experience.
I can't remember off the top of my head. And
I wouldn't be surprised because they're awful.
Given that credit score agencies are probably the most litigious people on the planet, I don't think I'm going to randomly pick one of the three I could name and accuse it of being them. But
yeah, we're not responsible for what Popey says on this podcast.
Probably is Experian then.
Yeah. If you're going to sue someone, go and sue Canonical. Yeah. That's canonical.com.
Hey, I'm off the clock.
But yeah, no, this is a real thing, but it's kind of invisible. And some of that's because obviously putting forward a law such as this would fail the laughs test in most Western democracies. But equally, it can be sort of smuggled in through the back door and it has a similar effect. And if you're going to do this, is it better to be explicit about it?
Well, God, there's so much buried in this.
I know. I mean, this is a really big question that I've just sprung on you with no thought, because I hadn't thought of it until we started discussing this.
I know that a pattern in this show is that we say, that sounds like a segment, and then we don't actually end up doing a segment on it. But I would like to do a segment on this, which is like your, you know, civil human being score.
I'm putting it in the show notes.
I think
it's serious.
I think the general reaction should be, if it sounds like it either has been or should be a Black Mirror episode, it's a bad thing. And this has been a Black Mirror episode, therefore it is a bad thing. I think that's
the new test, isn't it? Totally. Could it be a Black Mirror episode? I like that.
Well,
that is a fucking creepy show, by the way. I've only watched a few episodes of it.
half
well,
the score
dark. Thing totally has been a Black Mirror episode. There's a woman who tries to buy a house and she's trying to save up and she can't buy a house in the area because she doesn't have enough nice ratings. And she tries to, like, you know, give stars to the guy who sells her coffee, and she tries to give stars to the everyone she interacts with. But, you know, she has a poor encounter and her rating is dropped right down. She can't get a decent hire car. You know, she can't get on public transport. There's, like, so many effects. And it totally is what's happening in China. Like,
a lot of people who try to invent techno utopias seem to found an awful lot of it on a kind of a social reputation score. I mean, Daniel Suarez did it in Demon, and Cory Doctorow did it in Down and Out of the Magic Kingdom, and stuff like that. So people seem to think this is a good idea, but as soon as you see it put into practice, A, in Black Mirror, and B, in China, you think, wow, this is the worst idea imaginable, isn't it? I don't want to live in this appalling dystopia that you have created with my social credit score.
It's not even that there's, like, details that they've, like, oh, if only they'd tweak it slightly. It's like, no, they've taken photos of you and they're shaming you. Like, There is no real detail in that that you could tweak. That go, no, if you just made it just a tiny bit better. No, there is no better, really, I don't think.
Well, can I continue the China theme into another news item? So there's been some rumblings for a while about Google working on a search engine for China. This was, I believe, it was surfaced, if I remember correctly, and then Google CEO Sundar Pichai talked about it at the Wired 25 summit, and he said, it turns out we'll be able to serve well over 99% of the queries. And he said that there are many, many areas where Google could provide information better than what's available. This did not go down very well with Google employees, and this project is known as Dragonfly, and apparently a bunch of employees have signed a petition for this. Amnesty International put out a video that was pretty scathing of it, and I read somewhere that there's going to be a protest happening, I think today, actually, as we record this.
What's the objection? Why are employees of an American company upset that the company is providing services to citizens in another country, and that specific country is China?
So the petition, I think, says, if Google is willing to trade human rights for profit in China, could they do the same in other countries?
The issue is that the Chinese government have said to Google, yeah, you can run a search engine in our country, but you have to censor it to our requirements. What employees want Google to do is to say, we don't agree with that kind of thing, so we're not going to build it, rather than we will pander to your censorship of your citizens because you'll pay us to do so. Now, that's a massive oversimplification of the problem, but that's essentially how it's being presented. And if you're on the wrong side of the argument from Amnesty International, you should at least sit down and have a conversation with yourself about whether you're doing the right thing, in my opinion.
Right. So I'm a little confused because, forgive me, but as I understand it, a significant number of people who work for Google probably have Android phones, which are manufactured in China, and those devices will have been made by people who live under an oppressive, what they would call an oppressive regime, and yet they still buy those things. But their employer does it, provides services to those people in that country. That's different. How?
I think their argument probably is, and I don't 100% agree with this argument, but I think their argument is probably, you know, we make software and we have historically had a view of don't be evil. That's been retracted, but there's still a desire to not be evil. And that, you know, we want to work for a company who is not working with oppressive regimes or suppressing human rights and this, that, and the other. And I think from a simplistic perspective, that's a reasonable request to make. Mm-hmm. But I don't think the world is that simple. And as we see consistently in any kind of political discourse, people are mainly willing to desire to boil things down into simplistic summaries that evade any kind of nuance that might challenge their viewpoint. So to me, I see that. To me, there's two questions wrapped up in this. One is, is it right for Google to make the search engine with China, in, you know, working with the Chinese government and in China? And then the second question is, what right do the Google employees have over broader strategic focus in Google?
Okay, well, on the first point then, one of the things you said there about how their motto used to be don't be evil and then it changed, Google did say, we don't agree with China's censorship of the internet and we're not going to support it in 2010. And now they appear to have changed their minds, but they never said, oh, actually, we've decided it's a good idea. They've been building Dragonfly in secret. And I think that's the sort of thing that gets up a lot of people's noses. Now, whether you agree with them or not, I think that's what's motivated a lot of the kind of visceral annoyance about this, that they're explicitly going back on a promise that they made and doing so in secret because they're getting paid for it in order to do things like block searches for the words like human rights. I mean, again, it's a lot more nuanced than that.
I'm not sure I would attribute too much to the fact that Google did it in secret, because Google do everything in secret. If you've ever been anywhere near a Google employee who has an Android phone that's got their internal dog food apps on it, they hold it very close to their chest and they don't let anyone see anything. They're very
all companies
conscious.
Do work in secret.
Right. And so particularly companies like Google do a lot of stuff in secret. So I don't think there's any particular... But... I just find it a little bit strange that I think it feels like Google employees are suddenly, for want of a better word, have more balls now than they had before. Like, more recently, they've complained that that Google worked with the Department of Defense, if I recall, recently.
Yes.
And that seemed fairly successful, whereas... You know, in the past, they might not have been quite so vocal. And now they've realized they can help affect the direction of their employer. And that's not an unreasonable thing, I think, for employees to do. I don't think workers should sit at the bottom of the pile and say, yes, sir, no, sir, and we'll just do whatever you want. I think it's reasonable if your paymasters are asking you to do something which you find morally questionable, whatever your ethics are, that you should question that. And if there's a significant enough group of you within the company who feel you could mobilize as a force and feel the same way that the company is doing something that's not in the best interest of customers, the shareholders, or potential customers in another country, then why not protest? Why not? I mean, it's going to go one of two ways, isn't it? You're either going to succeed and they're going to shut it down, or you're not, and they're going to carry on doing it because it maximizes shareholder value, because there's, you know, a billion or so people. They've maximized their revenue out of everyone in the United States and in some of the BRIC countries. So why not go for that one over there that's got a billion or more people who are potential customers?
I wholeheartedly agree with that. The idea, collective bargaining is a really important thing. The whole idea that the people in suits propose and the worker bees dispose is not reasonable. And as you say, the Google people have discovered they have this collective bargaining power. It's not just, oh, we just do what we're told because we're told by the people at the top. They say, we don't want to do this. The people who run the company have to listen to them.
Mm. Well, yes and no. It depends on the company. So some companies, such as financial services firms, very, very command and control. And they run an environment which is... the people at the top make the decisions. The people who aren't at the top follow those decisions. And that's how those cultures tend to work. And that's why I think you don't tend to see as much, you don't tend to see this kind of behavior that we're seeing with Google in a lot of those kinds of more traditional firms. I think part of the reason why we're seeing it in places like Google is for two reasons. One is, from what I understand, Google have fostered a culture that they want their employees to push back, that they want their feedback.
Yeah.
And that's a good thing. Right,
and they have, or at least they talk about having an underlying ethical basis for a lot of their actions. If you're working for a financial services company, they're like, okay, our job is to make money from people. Google's job might be that, but they at least talk about how our job is, we're collecting all the world's information for everybody. Making money is merely an epiphenomenon that we do in order to be able to continue the mission. Now, again, that's completely unfair to both of those companies, but it's... In the same way that if you work for someone like the BBC, there's a feeling that there's an underlying ethical basis to what you do, and so employees are much more likely to say, hang on, this doesn't feel right to me.
I'm not sure I'd entirely agree with that. I think the gist of what you're saying is correct, because I don't think of Google as an ethical company. I think of them as a company that makes products. But I also don't think that a financial services company, I don't think people are there just to make money and throw caution to the wind.
No, but if you had if you got one of those surveys through, like I often get these from YouGov, where they ask you, how many of these 50 brands do you recognize? And you go, tick, 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 the ones you recognize, and you ignore the ones you don't. And then they ask you, relatively, which ones do you feel positively about and which ones do you feel negatively about? If I put a list of brands in front of you and said, which ones do you think of these were ethical and which ones were not ethical, I'd be pretty confident that you'd push Apple and Google nearer the top than you would, you know,
Bank of America nearer the bottom.
HSBC, yeah. Or, you know, Nestle. Right.
I'm not disputing the consumer perspective of those brands. I'm talking about the companies themselves. Because Google are a consumer products company. They need to be seen and in a positive light. Otherwise, people aren't going to buy them. Aren't going to buy their products. Someone like Bank of America, to a reasonable extent, they are a consumer products company in some ways, but they're not in other ways. Like, I don't think that it's as incumbent on them in their marketing to get over the ethical side of things. I actually think that that's changing as well for banking. Without turning this into financial services, you see companies like Wells Fargo who have really screwed up a lot. And now a lot of their work is, or marketing is focused on that. My point mainly is, I think that the reason why we're seeing this kind of behavior is because Google have encouraged it. But secondly, also, Google hires a lot of younger people who are in engineering roles, who are in high demand. So you can go out and protest at Google. And if you decide you're going to leave because you don't like the Chinese search engine project, or even if
you don't like working for the Department of Defense or whatever.
Yeah. Or even if you get fired, it's no skin off your nose. You're just going to get a job at Facebook down the street. So it's like, but I think that's different. For example, if you're a worker bee in Bank of America, where the culture is very different, it's probably a lot more difficult for you to stick your nose above the pulpit and protest against it. So I think that's the reason why we see it with companies like Google. I don't know. I suspect that nothing much is going to change. Although Google's been in this, like in the crosshairs recently with the whole sexual, assault stuff and all of that stuff that's been going down.
The walkouts are only a month ago.
Well, right.
I think a lot of the large tech firms are. I mean, Facebook very definitely are. They're currently, as we record this, Facebook people are being interrogated into bits. Inside the House of Commons by MPs from the UK, from across Europe, from Canada,
right,
so on and so forth, all of whom are extremely annoyed that Zuckerberg refused to show up.
Yeah, I like the empty chair they did with him.
Yeah. So I think there's a lot of crosshair going on here, and Google and Facebook are obviously going to attract a lot of that. Because,
yeah.
But then you look at the Apple, there's currently a class action suit against Apple in the being heard by the Supreme Court in the US right now, basically accusing them of being a monopolist for iOS.
By the way, have you ever watched an interview with Tim Cook?
Yes.
I watched an interview with him on a flight. It was like 20 minutes long.
Hang on, you were on a flight or he was on a flight?
I was on a flight. I didn't watch an interview with him. Him sat in a plane seat talking to a guy.
I don't know. I mean, the guy probably flies around more than I do, right? He runs Apple. You'd think he shows up from place to place.
Was this an interview with him on Vice with a woman sat opposite him on a stool in a store?
It was at some business conference. Oh, okay. This guy. Yeah. And I don't know a huge amount about him or what he does, but I was really impressed with him. He strikes me as a really, like, I've said this before on Bad Voltage, like, one of the people I respect most in our world is Jim Whitehurst, who runs Red Hat, and I got a very Whitehursty vibe watching Tim Cook, and I was just curious if you guys had seen it, because yeah, I was very impressed.
I can see why people find him appealing, and why they like his stance on a few things. There are people in our community who hate Apple, and fair enough. But yeah, him as a person, I don't have a problem with.
Yeah.
And so different to Steve Jobs, who, from what I could understand, like, was smart, but basically yelled and until things got done. Like,
a person you'd want to work for.
Shall we move on?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Next.
Give us something else.
I've got a quick one in other Google news. Commit on a Google Fuchsia repo has set the Android community alight with speculation. Commit came from a Huawei developer, and it appears to enable the Fuchsia kernel, which is called Zircon, on their Kirin 970 CPU-based board. The internet extrapolation engine is now in overdrive, speculating that this means that the so-called Android replacement is being tested on the Honor Play series of Huawei devices. So for a long time, once Fuchsia was known about, people have speculated that this will be Google's play to replace Linux specifically within Android, and it'll be the next generation of devices. And this has helped to cement that that theory, because it's now on a device, or allegedly on a device, which previously ran Android, and potentially could maybe there's a partnership going on between Google and Huawei for prototype devices.
I have a question about this. I'm not sure if you guys have the answer to this question, but I've heard when we talked a bit about Fuchsia in the past, and it's quite an interesting project to follow. And I've heard before about how one of the desires here for Google is to replace Linux in the Android stack. And Fuchsia is very much seems to be built from the ground up, and the UI and everything is different and all the rest of it. I'm curious as to why there's so much of a focus on Linux, because I would have assumed that if you look at, you know, this set of Java libraries, which is Android, and this set of, you know, UI, UX kind of patterns and all the rest of it, and then you've got the underlying kind of services and the kernel, I would have thought that Linux would have been the least of their issues. I would have thought that this Java stack would have been the main problem.
Well, that bit's being replaced by things like Kotlin and other.
By Kotlin.
But as I understand it, the whole point of Fuchsia from Google to replace Linux, and I've long speculated that Samsung Tizen is to replace Android, you would still get the same UI on top. So it's not replacing everything from user space upwards. So you'd have the same applications, exactly the same experience, but the bit right at the bottom, the kernel, would be replaced for licensing reasons, to get away from the GPL. It's as simple as that.
Of course, yeah, that makes sense.
Yes, want to get away from the GPL. I mean, yeah, my opinion of Tizen is they don't really intend to make it a thing. It's just there. So if Google say, actually, we want Android and we've decided to do this, Samsung can go, well, if you piss us off too much, maybe we'll just switch to Tizen and we'll still be the biggest phone manufacturer on Earth. Mm-hmm. And then if we stop selling Android, where is your Android now? Nowhere is where it is. And so there's this kind of, it's the scene at the end of The Good, the Bad and the Ugly, where they're all putting the guns at one another, playing, eyes narrowing, all this kind of thing. And
you think? Do you really think that Tizen was just a backup plan?
Yeah.
No. Well, no, it wasn't just a backup plan.
I don't believe that for a second.
No, because it's still used in IVI, and it's used in some devices. But I think it's being kept on life support. But I do honestly believe that Samsung kept that going as a hedge for when Android turns bad or goes away.
Or turns against Samsung. I mean, I'm sure, yes, it has multiple motives. If you're sitting there putting together the business proposal to build Tizen in the first place, you can say, well, it's got this, you know, the mutual assured destruction gun held to the head of Google thing in case they decide to screw us. But also, we can put it in our IVI devices and we can actually build phones on it. And if it turns out that everyone on Earth loves it to bits and doesn't love Android, then fine, we'll just switch to it. No worries. Mm-hmm. But I'm reasonably confident that building it in itself was inherently kind of a bit speculative. I think of it like something like Ubuntu TV was. You build it, and then if people love it, then you carry on with it. If since people didn't love it, you know, Canonical don't have the resources to keep this kind of thing going, but Samsung, they go, well, we've got multiple purposes for this. They need something. Baidu is exactly the same on feature phones, right? They need something so Google can't just go, well, we can do what we like with Android and there's nothing you can do about it, because where else are you going to go? Apple aren't going to license you iOS, are they? But Samsung can say, we do have somewhere else to go.
Exactly. And so yeah. I think Fuchsia is certainly an interesting thing to watch. It's nowhere near at the level that Tizen is, but Google is a big company with a lot of resources, and it certainly could be, especially if they partner with companies like Huawei, who, you know, are keen to follow and get, you know, exclusivity on whatever the next big thing is that Google are doing.
The thing that I didn't quite understand about this was, you mentioned the internet extrapolation engine, but this is not a surprise, right? No. From the very first moment we found out about Fuchsia, they're obviously building it in order that it will eventually show up on devices and go to people. They're not just building it so we can go, we built a kernel. That's one thing off the bucket list, right? They're doing it for a reason. And part of the procedure where you build a kernel and then eventually it shows up on consumer things is a bit where you start testing it on real devices in the world, and that's where we are. This just seems like, you know, the obvious stage four in the 10-stage plan. It's not this big revealing surprise that now suddenly we know what Google are planning. We knew all along. Yeah, we said this on the show.
It's like a bit scary for people who are like fully paid up committed members with the penguin tattoo, for, you know, or for that stuff that they love to go away. You know, there's a bit of sadness there, I'd imagine.
I'll grant you that.
I mean, I'm not sure I agree about the Tizen thing. My theory about Tizen is, if you're a company like Samsung, I think you have two problems when you're shipping Android devices. The first one is you have a dependency on a platform that your competitor is using, that is building. And the second is that, you know, from what I understand, the quote Android open source project is an oxymoron. You know, it's very difficult to get code into the Android open source project. I've talked with two companies who, large electronics manufacturers who make phones, who've said to just people who've worked there, who've said that it's very, very difficult, almost impossible to get patches upstream. So you have that dependency. So I'm guessing that some reasonably high level worker bee at Samsung went and said, we should be building something, you know, to hedge it. But actually, they set out to actually build a platform that would replace Android. So Samsung would become that company. And my theory is that they invested a bit of money into it, and then they started building it, realized just how much work was involved, and then that project got defunded more and more. Because it doesn't seem like a huge amount of funding went into Tizen.
So you don't think it was a hedge. You think it was a genuine attempt, but then they realized that in order to do this properly, they'd have to chuck loads more money at it and couldn't justify it.
I'm guessing they went through a similar thing that we experienced at Canonical with the Ubuntu phone, which is, we're going to build this platform that's going to be better than Android. It's going to be better than iOS. And then when you actually get into, the devil gets into the detail, with the best will in the world, you realize, good grief, this is not just a huge technical undertaking, huge design undertaking, but then you've got to then go and sell this.
It's a huge marketing and sales undertaking as well.
Yeah, to get people to bring their apps over, and then as we discovered with Ubuntu Phone, like, people aren't going to do that unless you pay them. You want 200 grand to bring your app to Ubuntu Phone.
You need to be shipping the chicken and egg. You need to be shipping devices, and if you've got the budget to be able to ship devices in a country like India, where you know you can shift 1 million devices, you can motivate people to port their applications. And sure, the Tizen store is tiny, and there aren't a huge number of applications, but they do have WhatsApp, and so you know that's something we can never get.
Look at things like Kios, you know, and there's no reason why all of these answers can't be true. It wouldn't surprise me if when they put together the business plan for why Tizen should exist, there was, well, let's try it and maybe it'll work. Also, it's a hedge against Google. Also, we've got things to go on IVI. Also, it can be the operating system which runs, I don't know, the Samsung Echo, which I can't even think of the name
Bixby.
Thank you, yes.
Right. Sounds like a cartoon cat.
Yeah, it does. Yes.
Let's do something else. We're kind of coming into the finish line.
Yes.
Have you got anything, Langridge, that you want to show up?
I think I'm interested in your opinions. I read a relatively detailed thing about Twitter, and specifically recommending that if you see controversial tweets that you disagree with, then you shouldn't quote tweet them and say, I disagree with this. You should screenshot them and say, I disagree with this. Because if you quote tweet a thing, Twitter sees that as basically a vote for it, essentially. It's
right.
And if you disagree with a thing, you don't necessarily want to give it loads of airtime. You don't want Twitter to go, wow, loads of people are talking about this. It is controversial and therefore draws more eyes and therefore we will surface it more. Now, in the old days when what you saw on Twitter was things that your friends put out and that was it, that didn't matter because there was no ranking. But now that the Twitter timeline doesn't necessarily contain all the things your friends said and does contain stuff that Twitter have injected in, do we want to be caring about that kind of thing? And I don't know whether, I mean, this is a hugely pathological outcome to the thing. Like, screenshot sharing things is the worst idea in basically every way apart from this. Is this just the way things are now or what? I don't know how I feel about
it. I'm increasingly coming to the conclusion that Twitter don't know their ass from their elbow. And they, when it comes to building a platform, a hugely popular platform with millions of users, they just don't get it. Like, I realize I'm deviating slightly, but this is related. You cannot edit tweets, right? You can't downvote a tweet. You can only press a little heart button or reshare it to your timeline or reply to it. There's no way to say, this is shit, this is terrible, other than what? Resharing it and saying, this is shit, or taking a picture of it and sharing it and saying, this is shit. That is just ridiculous. That's a crap way to build a platform.
They don't want to enable people to have conversations about, this is shit. They clearly want this to be a more positive environment. I agree with the not editing tweet.
Well, they should get rid of the shitty people. If they want it to be a positive place, get rid of the negative people. That's like, there you go.
But then you're censoring people.
Yeah, totally.
Then you're censoring people.
Yep. Get rid of the shitty people. Call it censoring, call it whatever you want.
But then you've got to define who the shitty people are. That's a whole rabbit hole.
No, you define what the shitty people do. And if they do those things, then they go.
Right. They would argue that's the Twitter terms of service,
on that very specific point. An extra story that I saw, which I put in just to throw into this conversation. Hitman 2 has just come out, hugely popular game, and Sean Bean is
pronounced Sean.
What?
It's pronounced Sean, not Sean.
Shut up. Sean Bean is in it. He portrays a character, one of the designated targets. And people were tweeting very excitedly about how they got to kill Sean Bean. And then Twitter started banning them for hate speech because they were talking about killing Sean Bean. Now,
this is that guy ridiculous. Bombing an airport all over again, like saying.
I mean, obviously, as I understand it, this is now, they've now gone, oh yeah, we screwed that up, we've reversed it or whatever. And this is back to the AI automatically making decisions or whatever. But it plays into that thing of, if you want to stop people's shitty behaviour without employing an army of people to check every tweet, AI is going to do it and get it wrong a bunch of times. So, yeah, this whole thing plays into this discussion of what should we be doing about sharing things around.
I think this is in support of Popey's point, but to me, the root cause of this is not really Twitter. The root cause is that we as a society seem to have forgotten how to debate with each other without turning it into a bun fight. And consequently, you get platforms like Twitter, which are not designed to support effective debate, right? So I would love to be able to retweet someone's tweet because I'm supportive of it. But I can also see the perspective of someone wanting to engage in a constructive debate without necessarily shining the light in it. But to me, also, we should be able to shine the light on people we disagree with in a way that's constructive. And social media is removing that from our society, is that it just turns into shouting and shaming. That's what social media has become.
There's a lot of problems here. Like, other platforms have managed to build in a downvote button and the ability to hide people you think are shitty. Like, that is possible. Right. Reddit has had this for years, and it's possible. Like, even Slashdot had it, the ability to downvote comments and push the crap to the bottom, and you ignore that crap. If you want to, you can press the little plus and open it up and have a look at
that crap. But you know what happens there as well, and this happens all the time in Reddit, is that people downvote people they disagree
with. And
they downvote opposite opinions.
Right.
And then what happens is basically the hive mind wins consistently.
I'm not saying it's a perfect platform, and there are other places like Hacker News who have a similar problem, that there is the Silicon Valley hive mind that runs Hacker News.
Yeah, exactly.
But Twitter's doing it wrong. Like, they may not be doing it perfectly, but they're doing it way better than Twitter are. And I'm not convinced that we ever had the ability to have that discourse, and you assert that we lost it. I think the problem is we now have a huge number of objectionable fuckwits on the internet. And those are people that you would never have hung around with if the internet didn't exist. And if social media didn't exist, you wouldn't converse with these people because they're not in your social circle. And you generally, despite how much you want to interact with people who have opposing points of view, most people don't go out of their way in their real life to find people who have opposing points of view and have a chat with them. You have a social circle of people you have things in common with, not
right.
Like people who frequent are the Donald. That's just like normal.
Right.
And because of the internet, these people are now exposed to us and punching us in the face constantly. And that's.
I think to fix this, we have to fix the, and it's a much harder problem to fix, right? To me, I think there's things that you can do in platforms like Twitter and Facebook and LinkedIn and Reddit and whatever that you can very much add to support healthy discourse. There's no doubt about it, right? In fact, Discourse have baked a lot of things into their platform, which works along those lines. But I do think that part of the problem here is that people seem to, we need to be training. This is a generational thing. Like, we need to be training. Like, one of the things I'm wanting to do with Jack is training him that, you know, you should seek out opinions that are different to your own, right? The requirement is that they have to be respectfully communicated, right? So if you go and express a viewpoint and then someone calls you a cuck or something, right? That's not respectful. Fuck those people. But there is such a hive mind mentality in a lot of people that I think what happens is if somebody has a differing viewpoint, that the immediate hive mind view is you have to shut them down.
Right, but
the problem is that social media, due to your point, Popey, basically has created an environment where everybody gets a loudspeaker. So the fuckwits get a loudspeaker. But then also what's happening now is that people are fighting fire with fire. So people who weren't, there's so many people who I know, who I've known for many years, who I agree with, have become fuckwits because they now fight fire with fire. And so it's the only way to succeed in the online argument. That's what worries me.
To me, it feels, I'm honestly not sure how to describe it. It's basically that people having shrieking arguments is newsworthy, and people having a sensible, measured debate at which everyone concludes a good thing is not newsworthy.
Yeah, it's true.
People like to slow down and watch car crashes. What you have to do is you have to go, even though people want to do this, we have to stop them doing it anyway. And in order for that to happen, you've got to overturn society. So you have to say, well, you have to not be allowed to pander to the things that people want because they're a bad idea, even though people want them.
Right.
Essentially, this is why I'm a bit more in favour of government than a lot of people, because that's their job in a way that companies aren't.
But that's, I agree, but governments are shit at that.
I don't think governments are very good at it, is the problem.
But also, where else do you turn, right? I mean, companies are shit at it.
That's the point. I mean, maybe the space aliens from the planet Zanussi come down and enforce it upon us.
The planet Zanussi? Wow. Thank God we have Space Force. So, on that bombshell, I guess we should probably wrap things up. I would love to hear what people think about this. So, like, I think this end bit is particularly interesting. I'd love to hear, like, what is the balance between what you can do in platforms like Twitter, which the three of us would all agree are not doing a particularly great job at solving this problem.
Agreed.
But then also, what needs to happen outside of that? What needs to happen in our schools? What do parents need to do with their kids? What does the media need to do to encourage the right kind of discourse? All that kind of stuff. I'd love to hear practical ideas around what people think people should be doing there. Community.badvoltage.org.
Yep. Or join the Slack channel. This is such a big topic. It might be the only topic. I mean, it's interesting that we've had a bunch of disparate, different, collected by different people news items, but they're all sort of about the same thing.
Yep.
Well, the world is shit. Let's all give up.
That is another one of the underlying threads.
I'd be interested to hear from feedback from people that isn't, I deleted my Twitter account and that solved the problem for me. I would be interested in hearing things other than that.
Yeah, yeah. What's the middle ground? You know, how can social media play a role that is positive?
We all came out of the open source world where there's a contributory mentality. Part of the reason you're doing things is in order to help solve problems for other people. It's not just, I'm doing this because it works for me and that's it. Because that tends not to be a very open source sort of mindset. You know, if you feel like that, why would you bother doing open source? You don't care whether it works for other people, right? You just write a patch and then leave it on your hard drive. So, yeah.
Well, Bacon for President, 2020. This will solve this problem. I tell you what,
that's the only thing that makes me more glad that I don't live in America than anything else.
You know, I tell you what will be solved. Those fuckers who don't indicate when they change lanes, that'll be solved if I became president.
Given you were born in Congress,
given you were born in Kenya, do you qualify?
I mean, much as North Yorkshire is a bit basic,
yes,
it is not Kenya. It's a little different to Kenya.
Yeah, he wasn't born in Kenya. He was hatched in North Yorkshire.
Thank you for that.
Actually, I'm sure your dad told me that he just found you one day under a stone and just took you.
He actually bought me with tiger tokens.
Showing your age there.
All right.
Bloody tiger tokens. Oh, dear.
All right. It's time. It's time to end. I'm hungry. I need some lunch. All right. Well, Popey. Always, always a pleasure. Thank you for coming on. We always love having you on the show.
Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you for inviting me.
Maybe when we talk about the segment that we said we'd talk about, maybe we should bring Popey on and have a foursome.
Yeah, well, that seems reasonable.
I'm not sure the universe can cope with me and Jeremy on at the same time, though, really.
On the other hand, have you ever seen them both in the same place?
This is true.
And there's only one microphone between us. So.
Right.
That sounds like an awful romantic novel.
This has been Bad Voltage episode 43. Thank you very much.
Bye.